Campus FM jippreżenta Mistiċi Nisa, program li jitratta dwar nisa magħrufa għall-esperjenzi mistiċi u l-kitbiet spiritwali tagħhom. Produzzjoni u preżentazzjoni Pauline Dimek. Welcome to our series. This is the 13th program in our series, and this time the program is going to be in English. Together with us, we have Mr. Pete Farrugia, and our mystic today is Julian of Norwich, a very exciting figure, Pete.
Yes, she is.
And you're our expert today on this great woman. Just give us some background. Tell us who she was and where she comes from and... You know,
I don't know whether I would call myself an expert, but she's certainly a figure that I have a lot of respect for and that I spent a relatively long time researching and writing about. So Julian is a female mystic in the English tradition, the East Anglian tradition. She was born in the mid-late 1300s and died around 1416. She was in her early 70s when she died. And she is one of the most beloved mystics to have ever come out of England. In fact, she is recognized as a saint by the Anglican and the Lutheran traditions. However, she is not officially recognized as a saint by the Catholic Church, although her work is included in the Catechism of the Catholic Church, which is the most authoritative magisterial document which we have. So there's a certain...
She's
quoted directly in the Catechism. Mm-hmm. Specifically, she's quoted, we might get into this a bit later, her theological position that evil can be used by God to bring about a greater good. So that divine providence is always capable of taking something which appears to be not God and making it of God.
Wonderful. So how much do we know about her? What about the hagiography that exists? Is there anything really?
Biographically, we know very little. We have some really interesting details, though, and we can extrapolate something, but perhaps not too much from those. She was most likely a relatively educated woman. She certainly knew how to write and potentially how to read and write, which was not altogether common during the period. We think that she received her education from a Benedictine convent in a place called Carrow, very close to where she lived. And we think that because within the showings, within her writings, she uses greetings and welcomes which would have been specific to the Benedictine order. So there were certain ways of saying hello and goodbye, certain prayerful ways of doing that, which were specific to different orders. And the ones she uses are Benedictine.
So there is some connection with the Benedictines.
Definitely.
But was she herself ever a nun?
Some people think she might have been. Personally, I'm not so sure about that, because the fact that she embraced this anchoritic life, and when she talks about her illness, we get no indication that she was being tended to by sister nuns. I'm not sure. We don't even know if she was married, widowed, had children. We know very little about her life, except we know an awful lot about this most amazing moment of her life when Christ disclosed himself to her through these visions, 13 visions.
So I guess we can go into these visions straight away. Sure. What's so extraordinary about them? Because I've heard that there are some comments that she makes which are very strange, like, for example, seeing Christ as a woman.
Yes.
So tell us about her revelations.
Okay. Maybe starting a little bit before that, they began when she was very, very sick. She was dying, and a priest was called for because people thought that she needed to receive extreme unction, last rites, because she was dying, and a crucifix was suspended over her prostrate body, and that's when the visions began. She was deathly ill, and she suddenly saw this crucifix animate itself, and the suffering Christ spoke to and through her. Now, she spent a long time thinking about these visions before writing them down, and we have two texts based upon these visions, the short text and the long text. The long text is the product of her having thought about and really contemplated what she experienced, and adding a lot of theological and spiritual commentary to it. The short text is just the bare bones of these are my visions, this is what I saw and heard and experienced. When it comes to Christ as a woman, I think what she does is a very beautiful kind of metaphorical language, which is profoundly biblical, where we hear about things which are so beyond the remit of human experience that they have to be talked about metaphorically. And she talks about Christ as a woman, but really as a mother. And there are a lot of layers of domestic imagery, of homely imagery, which are very powerful in the way she expresses her visions. There's a beautiful one where she talks about Christ as a piece of cloth, as a piece of clothing. And she makes the connection between the swaddling clothes, which you would use to wrap a baby in this tight embrace, but also the shroud, which would cover a dead body. And Christ has this ambivalent, this paradoxical nature about him. He's man, he's God, he's alive, he's dead, he's alive again. And she uses these images to bring across just how amazingly beyond our imagination the love of God is.
You seem to be, to me, to be very religious, and you can almost identify with some of her experiences. Do you think everyone would read them so mystically, or can they be misinterpreted by some as madness or a result of her illness or, you know,
possibly
hallucinations?
I think that that's a very interesting question, which can be asked for everybody who's ever experienced a mystical moment in their lives. And I would hazard to say most of us have had this eruption of God's existence in our lives, whether we acknowledge it or not, and whether we make it a center point of our experience of life is another matter. For some people, it's something to be brushed aside or ignored. For others, it can become the defining moment of their existence. And I think this is what we find in Julian. She experienced something so amazing that she had to dedicate her whole life to it. And that's why she became an anchoress, an anchorite. And that's...
What are they?
That's something we don't know very much about these days. They were particularly common in the medieval period, especially in England. An anchoress or an anchorite is basically somebody who has chosen to inhabit, again, this very paradoxical, liminal, between space within society. They would live in a small cell attached to the side of a church and spend their entire lives there as a symbol of something which is alive and which is dead, as Christ in his tomb, who is dead but alive. And through that position, they would mediate between the church and their community, offering a symbol of Christian solidarity. And Julian certainly did that. She wasn't hidden away from her community. People would visit her. They would speak to her. One of her most famous guests, who I'm sure is known to many of your listeners, was Marjorie Kemp, another very famous woman mystic, who was perhaps even more extreme in some of her attitudes than Julian.
We have a program on her
in
wonderful. The series,
That's
actually.
Great. And Marjorie talks about having met Mother Julian, this renowned mystic, whose message is really about love. In fact, her writings are known as the Revelation of Divine Love.
What you said about the anchorites just reminds us how important it is, in order to understand these mystics, to look into the historical background, what was going on in the world and in the church at
yes.
the time. What is important for us to understand about that era before we can actually understand what Julian is all about?
I would say two things. The first would be that an effective kind of spirituality was very popular at the period. Even with the Benedictines, there had been the Bernardine reforms, Bernard of Clairvaux, who promoted this very effective kind of spirituality, very emotion-based, feeling. In fact, some of his sermons on the Virgin Mary, you can feel that Julian must have either heard them or knew of them somehow. So it's a very embodied, very visceral, very warm-hearted approach to spirituality. It's not this scholastic tradition where there is, in some ways, a separation between the head and the heart. The second thing, I think, is that, in a way, we cannot read her showings, her writings, without understanding who she was and where she was placed. Just like Origen talks about the Bible as the textual body of Christ, I think, in a way, the showings are the textual body of Julian and of her place within the anchor hold. She literally spent years and years in this tiny cell, attached to a church. One interesting, I think it's interesting point, in most East Anglian anchor holds, the small room, the cell, would have been attached to the northern side of the nave. The contemporary church of St. Julian, for some reason, known only to them, have moved it to the southern wall behind the sanctuary. I think, whether they knew it or not, this is a really beautiful transposition, because they've basically placed her cell much closer to the altar, to the place where Christ's, the miracle of the Mass is being performed on a daily basis. So on some level, maybe Providence has brought her even closer to the most important thing in her life.
I've never been to Norwich, okay. But if I understand you correctly, you have.
Yes.
Okay, so if there is anybody who would like to, in a way, get in touch, connect with Julian of Norwich, what is there to see and do in Norwich? Is there anything, this monument in her honour? Or
Norwich is beautiful. The cathedral itself is vastly impressive. I was there with a group of students and I was asked to speak to them about Julian's experience. I would recommend anybody who's in the area to go and look at the church of St. Julian, because it's a fascinating church. In fact, that area has seen so much history. I mean, the Lollard heresy trials would have happened not very long before Julian. So
Can you say something about them?
Well, this is when the Bible was being translated into English, and that was unfortunately perceived as a very dangerous thing by the Catholic Church of the period. And so people were killed and burned very close to where she would have been, which is why, interestingly, scholars think we have so few direct scriptural inclusions within her text, just in case someone might have thought she was reading an English Bible.
I see.
However, I don't necessarily think one has to go to these places to be in contact with her. I mean, she is a living being. She might not be officially recognized as a saint by the Catholic Church, but if she is in communion with God, then she's with us whenever we want to reach out and commune with her. And I think doing that through her writing is the most powerful way to do it.
What impresses you most about her writings?
The fact that this is a woman living in a time when women were not given an authoritative role within the church, within society, within the culture in general, and yet through this vision, she's ventriloquizing the voice of Christ. She is speaking in the person of Christ, and that gives her immense authority. And she used that authority to spread the most beautiful message of God's unfailing love. And that's a really wonderful way to use power. It transforms power into authority, which is a non-coercive, caring way of saying divine providence. In fact, the most famous words from Julian of Norwich, which were used by T.S. Eliot, and they've been used by so many people, all shall be well, all shall be well, and all manner of things shall be well.
And that's the part which is quoted in the Catechism as well, isn't it?
That's also included. It's also in, yes. And I think those words, even in Malta, I know so many people who know those words and might not know where they come from, because that is basically a prayer of affirmation in our faith that God's providence is limitless, that in the end, love will triumph.
If I'm not mistaken, she's also considered to be an important figure within the English language and literature scene.
Oh,
she
was the first. Yes, I almost forgot to say that. Her book is the first book we know of to be written by a woman in the English language. So how wonderful that the first book written by a woman in English is this book, which is this message of acceptance and of care. Her vision of sinfulness is also interesting, and potentially it was a little bit avant-garde at the time, that it's important that being sinful is the way that we can allow God into our lives to forgive us. That between the penitent and the confessor, power does not rest, as we think, or as lots of people might think, with the priest who is going to stand alter Christus to forgive you. It's with the person who is bringing the sin, who is bringing this moment of pain and of disconnection, and asking to be reconnected to Christ. And that's how she understood sinfulness. And I think that's a much more healthy way than approaching the sacrament of confession, feeling like, oh, I'm not worthy. There's something. No, I mean, you're bringing something unclean to be made clean. Mm-hmm. You're making the miracle possible.
There's a huge interest in Julian of Norwich, even academically, isn't there?
Yes.
Can you tell us something about that?
I think it does rest a lot on the fact that she is a woman mystic, writing, and also it's interesting to think about her in terms of the English tradition vis-a-vis the continental tradition. In continental Europe, mystical visions and all sorts of things were a lot more common. For example, there's a famous, sort of quite funny case of a woman called Christine Ebner in Germany, and she went to a convent and she wrote letters to her family saying, this is so disappointing, none of these women have visions, they have no mystical experiences, what am I doing here? She went on to make up for it in no small way, because she had this ectopic pregnancy, I guess, and she ascribed it to divine intervention. So she really made up for the lack of mystical experiences in her convent. Whereas in England, even the rules, which were written in the 12th century, they tell anchoresses, be as sober as possible. Don't invite visionary activity. Try not to be like your cousins across the channel. So Julian broke the mold in a way. She went to that mystical place and she wrote about it. And these visions were disseminated and they inspired generations of people.
In fact, I believe that for many years, women were actually discouraged to have mystical experiences. Mm-hmm. I mean, as if they had, you know, someone could have control over one's mystical experiences. You don't have control over, your mystical experiences. But they were discouraged to try and bring them on. So
I agree with you. Obviously, the most one can do is be open to that mystical experience. It can't be fabricated, because it is, as we said before, this eruption of God's life into the creaturely life of our existence. What I think was problematic, more so than don't have mystical experiences, is don't try to take authority onto yourself through... So it was more of a misogynistic rather than, I think, pastoral concern. Because this is a way that women could. Another great example are the nuns of Helfta, like Gertrude and Mechtild of Magdeburg. They did this in a very powerful liturgical way. These were, not to deviate from Julian, but just for a second, these were women who found opportunities to expand the liturgy of the Mass and include themselves in it through the practice of fasting, which was basically singing ornamentation into the responses, and that was a wonderful thing to do. That's a way of making yourself part of the mystery rather than being always on the periphery. And that's why Julian is so amazing, because as this anchoress, she was on the periphery, she was attached to the church, but she wasn't in the church, she was outside the church, and yet she made that peripheral place, that place of marginalization, a new center for the the incarnation of Christ's love.
Did she have disciples?
Not explicitly, no. As an anchoress, she was not founding anything new. I think that she's probably had hundreds of thousands of disciples
since.
I would count myself among them. So her legacy is immense.
I don't know what impresses you most in the showings. The showings and the revelations is the same one, isn't it? Okay, it has with different names. I told you about some of the more exotic, I mentioned some of the more exotic about Christ being a woman, and you mentioned him being a mother, so, you know, which changes things around a bit. But what else do you think people find so fascinating in that today?
Another famous image of hers, there are so many, but one of the most famous ones is where she talks about Christ opening his hand and having a hazelnut in his hand, and talking about all of creation being held within this tiny, seemingly insignificant thing. All of reality being lovingly cradled in the hand of God. She also talks about, she overlays images of wounds, like the wound in Christ's side, which we are invited to enter, wombs. So this idea of Christ, of God as this womb, which is life-giving and sustaining, and also the tomb, because her anchor hold, in fact, is an image of a tomb. The ritual for making somebody an anchoress or an anchorite is not too dissimilar from a funeral mass. So she's dying to her community so she can be reborn in this new way of life.
The idea of liminality, which you mentioned earlier.
It's threaded throughout her whole writings, her life. Very much a figure at the boundary.
Besides prayer, though, they would also have probably done a lot of charitable work, or wouldn't they?
They would never have left the anchor hold. In fact, it ends with the bishop or whatever prelate is performing the liturgical ceremony, scooping up some of the dust from the ground, scattering it over them as though you're, and then sealing the door, and they would never leave that room again.
Mm-hmm.
However, she would have visitors.
People would interpret that as a reason why she had these fascinating, you know.
I'm sorry, I didn't make that clear. She had her visions before. Okay. She became an anchoress as a result of those visions.
I see.
She had those visions when she was very sick.
Okay.
She went.
And that was not while she was an anchoress.
No,
but
she became an anchoress because
that's very significant.
I have to dedicate my whole life to this gift which I've been given, and that's what she was doing. It's like Saint Francis in a way. He had this experience, and then his whole life was consumed by that experience. Being an anchoress was a vocation she received as a result of her mystical experience, not through it.
Did she write herself, or did she have a scribe? Our medieval mystics actually had either spiritual directors who wrote for them or who published their works.
We're not sure. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, we can never be completely sure. The oldest text we have, which is the shorter text, is again not directly contemporaneous with her. So we don't know whether she would have written things down herself or would have dictated them to people who visited her. It is possible. I personally think that she would have been able to read and write, and that it would have been something she could have done. When people visited her, it's interesting that she might have spoken to them through a curtain, so they wouldn't have seen her directly. And there was a cross embroidered on this curtain. So all of her communication with the outside world was mediated through this image of the crucified Christ, which is the first vision she had, was of Christ's crucified body suspended above her.
Besides that statement, which we've used about all manner of things shall be well, would you say that there is any text that is particularly significant? Obviously, an extract from the showings that I think everyone should know about?
I think it certainly the all shall be well, all manner of things shall be well, is it encapsulates the message in a very succinct way. And I think that that's why it has proven to be the most popular and the most enduring. However, I think, there are certainly other ideas which she brings to the table which need to be looked at, which we've touched upon a little bit during our conversation, such as this idea of sinfulness as being a doorway into Christ's love, this idea of divine providence being something we have to trust. It's about, really, her whole life is about how much she trusted in God and wholeheartedly, which is a very Marian thing to do as well. So I think that this is something which parallels with that, you know, Bernard of Clairvaux fascination with the identity of the Virgin Mary.
Just one last question, Pete. Did she have to face any challenges, whether personal or ecclesial?
She certainly speaks about some personal challenges. One of the things she focuses on is a sense of spiritual restlessness and malaise. And a lot of the 12th century rules for anchoresses talk about that too. And they say try and overcome it by prayer, especially the Psalms. She did that, but she also used that energy to create a sense of solidarity between herself and the people who would visit her, people who wanted advice from her. When it comes to ecclesiastical to challenges between her and the authority of the church, I think she was very clever in becoming an anchoress, because she was part of the institution, but also, as we've said throughout, outside of it. So she inhabited this very beautiful, very fertile place, paradoxically, because it's a place of death, but also a place of intense, enriching life within and without of the church.
Thank you very much, Pete. The time we had allowed, you know, is over. And, you know, we hope that our listeners enjoyed the program and found it as fascinating as I did.
Thank you, Pauline.
Thank you very much. And goodbye. Għadkom kem smajtu Mistiċi Nisa, program li jitratta dwar nisa magħrufa l-qdusija għall-esperjenzi mistiċi u għall-kidbit spirituali tagħhom. Produzzjoni u prezentazzjoni tiegħi Pauline Dimek. Program għall-Campus FM. Kull min jixtieq jisma' xi program minn din is-sensiela jista' jidħol fis-sit www.multauniversitybroadcasting.com u jmur fis-sezzjoni Webcasts.